Thank you, Ed. I want to thank you, sir, as chairman of the department, and your colleague Lois Shelton as director of the Poetry Center for co-sponsoring this twin bill. Yesterday was her day, and tonight is mine, and we're delighted to have Jay Laughlin and Mrs. Laughlin as our guests. I'm up here not because I'm chairman of the Friends of the Library, but because Jay Laughlin asked me to be up here and pitch questions to him, to be an interlocutor, because he has an abhorrence of a formal lecture. He doesn't realize this is a dangerous thing to put Larry Powell on the stage. But I'm going to do my best, Jay, to control myself. But there are a few things I do want to say. On this, your first visit back to Tucson in, what is it, 40 years?
About 40, I'd say.
Yeah. Slight change in the weather. He came in the spring, I guess, before, and camped on the desert. This time he came down in an amphibious vehicle from Utah, and we have put on a pretty nice day for him today, and he got some golf in. I sent a postcard this morning to a gentleman in Purchase, New York, regretting his absence. And I said, "Dear Alfred Knopf, if you could be with us tonight, I'd confer the Nobel Prize on you jointly with Jay Laughlin, the Nobel Prize for publishing. Of course, there is none. But here are the two outstanding American publishers of the 20th century, without any doubt. And of the two, the most daring is certainly our guest tonight, because he published Unknowns more than Mr. Knopf, who, unless his wife went out and brought them in alive, tended to be a more conservative publisher. But Jay Laughlin has been willing to take chances when no other publisher would. This is also our first meeting in 40, or second meeting, our first re-meeting in 42 years. I was a junior typist at UCLA, pecking away on my typewriter in the order department, and this tall, very tall man came in and looked down at me at my little typewriter and said, "I'm Jay Laughlin, and I've come to thank you and UCLA for being the first library in the United States to place a standing order for every book published by New Directions." And this was a pretty bold thing, I must say, that I got my boss there to do in 1939. I guess, when I first came on those annuals that you published. He looked down at me, and I looked down at his feet. They were bare. He was wearing Mexican sandals. And when I invited him to come back and come out and speak, I said, "Jay, do you still have those sandals?" Like a good Scot, he replied, "Yes. Do you want me to bring them?" Many a young man from a wealthy industrial family has gone to Harvard and gone back into the family business, whatever it was. Here was the exception, who came up from Pittsburgh through Choate to Harvard and did not go back to the Jones and Laughlin steel mills. He told me he'd made that resolve early. He went on instead overseas, and I'd like to ask him, if he would, to account for what led to this bold move. He didn't finish his degree that year. He went abroad and finished it later. What took you, what was the motive, Jay, that led you to leave Harvard and go off to Europe when you were still a boy, really?
Well, before I answer that question, I'd like to say what a great pleasure it is to be with Larry here. He must certainly be one of my oldest friends from California. And although I haven't often seen him as I would wish, we've been in touch one way and another. And he sent me the series of wonderful little memoirs and tributes and books that he has published in such beautiful format. And he is, I would say, perhaps the outstanding bookman, in the good sense, in our country. To get now to why I ran out on Harvard after my freshman year, it was simply because I was bored to death. This is not reverential, but it's the truth. I got there, I think, in 32 or 33, and it was between two great generations of Harvard English professors. The old boys like Kittredge and Lowes and Copy and those had retired, and the new great generation of Teddy Spencer and F.O. Matheson and that group had not yet come on. And the luminary of the English department, at least of the poetry part of the department, was a fellow named Robert Hillier. And frankly, he was dismal. He thought of himself as a poet. And so that you may evaluate his standing, I will recite the first two lines of one of his most famous poems, which went as follows. 1, 2, 3, 4, the swift canoe and the shadowy shore. Actually, I think he did win a Pulitzer Prize once, but I think he must have had the jury rigged. And he was also not very endearing because if in his class you mentioned the name of Ezra Pound or of T.S. Eliot, you were invited to depart the classroom. So the only real fun at Harvard for people of literary aspirations that year were Healing the Advocate. That was the literary magazine where there were some really superb, bibulous parties. James Agee, you may remember him, a very great writer, is dead now, is the head of the Advocate. And he liked a little nip, and he would share it with the healers, the fellows who were trying to make the magazine. So I got really pretty fed up then, and fortunately, however, I had had in Choate a marvelous English master, and you may have heard of Dudley Fitts. He was the man who did those wonderful translations of the Greek tragedies with Robert Fitzgerald, who has since translated the Odyssey and so forth. And Fitts had, he had inoculated me with the virus of modern literature. I mean, when I came to Choate, I knew nothing about any literature at all. Because in Pittsburgh, the books were only there to fill the library shelves, and the only person who ever touched them was the Irish maid who dusted them every 2 weeks. But in Fitz, under Fitz's tutelage, I had started reading modern literature and also reading the classics that he put me onto. And through him, I learned about Joyce and about Eliot and about Pound, about Gertrude Stein, and I also, which rather surprised me, learned about Thomas Wolfe, who didn't seem to me to be exactly Fitz's type of author, because, you know, Wolfe's motto was, why do it in one adjective if you can do it in five? Fitz had been corresponding with Pound in Italy through a connection that he'd had with Lincoln Kirstein's magazine, The Hound and Horn, which was not a hunting magazine. It was a very highbrow, wonderful literary magazine, and this is a magazine that Pound always referred to in his letters as the Bitch and Bugle. So Fitz, I told Fitz about, you know, how disgruntled I was at Harvard, and he said, well, I'll write to Pound. And he did write to Pound, and Pound said, send him over. And if he ain't too dumb, maybe I can drill something into his head. This was the way Ezra talked. He had a wonderful Cracker Barrel accent. He preserved, although he's an expatriate, he preserved his Americanism to the days of his death. And he had about five or six marvelous accents, which I may have something to say about later. So I went over there and went down to Rapallo, and we seemed to hit it off right away, and he accepted me into his private college, which was called, he called it the Ezuversity. And this was a great institution. First of all, it had It had no tuition at all. You didn't have to pay anything. All you had to do was to pay for your own meals, and he found me a little room where I boarded with an old German lady for about $4 a week in those days, if you can believe it. And he found me an old lady to teach me Italian, Signorina Canessa, who was a dear old lady who hated Mussolini passionately because he had put a tax on canaries. The curriculum in the college all took, well, there were three parts of the educational program in Pound's College. First, he would lend me books from his own library. And these were, of course, fascinating to read. And he lent me all of the books that he thought a young man who had his tastes malformed by what he called that beanery at Harvard should read. And one of the most fascinating parts of this reading his books were his marginal notations. As he'd go through the book, he'd write in pencil what he thought about the author, even if it was a famous classic author. And the most frequent notation was one which was written in capital letters, and it said, B-A-L-L-S, exclamation point. The second part of the curriculum took place at lunch and dinner, when we would, Ezra took, because his wife was a lovely English lady, a descendant of Shakespeare's brother, who, of course, being a lady, could not possibly learn to cook. All of the meals were taken in the Albergo Rapallo, but which Ezra referred to as the Albugaro Rapallo. And we would be gathered there at lunch, Mrs. Pound and myself and Ezra and whoever else. The population of this college was very fluctuating. People would drift in, stay for a few days, go on, stay for a week or so. I stayed actually for nearly a year. And whoever was there would participate in listening to his monologues and occasionally in a timid voice offering some very slight conjecture as to the veracity of the professor's remarks. And what he would usually start the day's work with at lunch would be he would read his mail to us. And he had an enormous correspondence with people all over the world, most of it having to do with economics, because as you may recall, in about the 1920s, when he was living in England, he fell under the spell of C.H. Douglas, the founder of social credit, and this became an obsession with him for the rest of his life. The gist of social credit is that you blow up the banks and you return the issuance of currency to the people. Very nice arrangement, but it never worked out. But the mail would be done first and a great deal of comment. Then after that, he would drift off into whatever was on his mind, and we would sort of try to steer him, of course, to literature and the ancient classics and the modern classics and to stories about his friend Joyce and his friend Yeats and so forth. And He was marvelous because he could mimic everything that he'd ever heard. He had Joyce's accent down to pat, and he had Yeats's accent down pat. And he was really great in imitating Yeats. And if you'd like, just to give you a sample of the way he talked, this is a bunch of, I have about 1,000 letters from him, and I've culled out a few that are interesting, and here's one I can read about Yeats, and I'll try and read it in his imitation of Yeats. This is Ezra imitating Yeats. This is from a letter he wrote me in 1934.
The aged Yeats left yester. I had several serious reflections, redoing a formal document, requesting you to chloroform me before I get to that state. However, must be a trial to be Irish in Ireland.
He could do this on anybody, you know, that he'd ever heard. I mean, he was a priceless mimic. So that was one phase of the curriculum. Now, I guess we've been on two phases now. And then the third phase was the athletic program. And this was really delightful because Ezra loved to play tennis. There was a fairly decent court in Rapallo, and he sort of fancied himself. He had a He had the most cannonball, not a serve, but what he liked to do was to get in the middle of the court, sort of about 10 feet back of the net. And he was quite hefty already in those days, and he would just wait there till the ball came, and then he would pivot around. And with this terrific pivot, he would smite the ball, and nobody could return it. And sometimes he hit it so hard that it wedged itself into the mesh of the wire at the back of the court. That was fun. And then other days, if it was hot, as it got to be often, we would go out swimming in the beautiful Tigulian Gulf, which is the Rapallo, as you know, is just down the line from Genova, and it's a very beautiful bay there with Portofino, romantic Portofino, standing out with its lighthouse at the end of the thing. And we'd go out in what was called a patinoi. A patinoi was two pontoons and two cross seats and oarlocks. We'd go out in this, and the reason, of course, for going out into the bay was that the sewage from the town of Rapallo ran onto the beach. But he loved swimming. We had very good time swimming. He was a good swimmer. And then if it was raining, the thing that we did is, Rapallo, right behind it, has steep mountains going up, beautiful mountains. And they are all threaded with what are called salite. These are little steep paths made with cross pieces of stones all the way up the hill. And we would walk up, if it was raining, up these hills and look into this beautiful region where the peasants had their olive trees behind stone walls and so forth. And he loved cats. And if we were going walking, he would always take a few snacks from the Albugaro Rapallo. And we would go up along and the cats would be waiting for him. I mean, cats are very smart. On a rainy day, they'd get on top of these low walls and waiting for Ezra. And Ezra would come up with his snacks, and he'd say, "Michi, Michi, vieni qua, Michi, Michi," and the cats would all come and get fed. So, as you can see, it was a very diverting college to attend. Then the other final part of it, I suppose you would call the arts program, and the arts program took place in the local movie theater. Ezra would get up in the back balcony with his. He wore a cowboy hat. And he'd be up there with his cowboy hat, stuffing peanuts with his feet up under the ledge of the beginning of the balcony. And we watched these terrible, in those days art had not arrived in the Italian cinema. These were the worst pictures you have ever seen. Absolutely the worst. And he loved them. And he would bellow with laughter. And I always went with him because I would be able to pick up a few words of Italian from each attendance at the movies. But that was the Ezuversity, and it was a great beginning, and I wish that I could have stayed longer, but there was so much pressure from my family to come back to Harvard, and Ezra finally said, "Well, yes, you better go back and finish up, and then they'll think you're a good boy, and it'll be nice to you." So it worked out.
Didn't you go really with a bundle of your own poems?
Yes, I took a few poems, and I tried to write others when I was there.
What did he say?
Well, he thought they were terrible. I would take a venture to show them to him. I would never show them in public at the school lunches. I would show them later at tea. Sometimes he'd invite me to tea. And I'd show him these things, and he'd start to look at them, and he'd fuss with his glasses, and then he'd get out his stub pencil, and he'd start crossing out words, and he'd say, "You don't need that word, and you don't need that word," and then finally he'd say, "Well, this is what you really mean to say," and he'd write it out. Unfortunately, those notes, I'm sure I have them somewhere, and I'm going to find them, because they're really little treasures. But he thoroughly discouraged. He said, "You're never going to be able to, you're never going to make a writer," he said. Of course, I was writing stories, too, but he wouldn't look at those because he said, "There's no point in your wasting your time with fiction."
Didn't you publish a story in the Atlantic Monthly when you were still at Choate?
Yes, but he didn't want to see it.
Did he like that?
He wouldn't read it.
That was because of the Atlantic Monthly, not because of you, I'm sure.
He said that there was no point in wasting your time with fiction because, he said, Stendhal, Flaubert, Joyce, and Henry James had done everything that could possibly be done in fiction, and therefore, why bother to try? But these poems he would look at, and then he told me, he said, "You're never going to make a writer. It's hopeless." And so I said, "Well, what am I going to do?" And he said, "Well," he said, "you must do something useful." So I said, "Well, what's useful?" He thought about that, and then he said, "Well, you might assassinate Henry Seidel Canby." Canby was one of his bete noir. Canby was the editor of the Saturday Review, and he wrote that immortal essay in which he proved that there was no character development in Ulysses. But I said, "How am I going to get away with it?" He thought about it, and he said, "No, you're not smart enough." So then I said, "Well, what else useful can they do?" And he thought about that, and he said, "Well, you might become a publisher." And that's what happened. And the deal was that if I would go back to Harvard and learn to be a publisher, he would let me publish some of his books, and he would give me letters of introduction to his other writer friends, such as William Carlos Williams and other people, and that's how I got to be a publisher.
And how many years ago was that? What was the year?
That was 1936 that the first little pamphlet was put out with the name New Directions on it.
Knopf published first in 1914, but then he's an old man in his 90s.
Right.
You still could overtake him, I suppose.
I wouldn't do that.
Well, we'll keep the Nobel Prize split between you. You went up to Paris at some point. Was it after you came back to Harvard? Did you ever graduate from Harvard?
I finally did in 1939, but I kept taking leaves of absence so that I could go back to Europe. And
Could you transfer your credits from the SU University?
No credits. No grades. Wasn't even pass-fail. All you had to do to stay in that college was just to listen attentively.
Well, it's not a bad idea. I think having taught and having had students, they're an excellent idea, Jay. You went back to Europe, and who did you fall under then?
Well, I'm a little perplexed on the chronology, but the next...
I'll just make it up. It doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't.
They're taking notes, but they don't mean a thing.
The next big influence in my life was Gertrude Stein.
Yeah, that's what I want you to say.
And this was a very odd connection coming, putting it along with Ezra, because Gertrude Stein had... referred to Ezra in one of her, I guess it was in her autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, she spoke of Ezra and she said, he was a village explainer. Very good if you want to explain a village. And Ezra was even less complimentary about Gertrude. He wrote to me, as I remember, and he said, "I hear you've been seeing the old tub of guts."
Awful.
Watch out. But she was a very fascinating woman, one of the most charismatic I have ever known, in spite of the eccentricities of her writing, which are really not so eccentric. I mean, if you read the essays about her by William Carlos Williams, who took her very seriously, she was really up to something that needed to be looked at, which was the question of how you clean up words and divorce them from their old associations and how you tinker around with new kinds of syntax and that sort of thing. I got to see her because, in a funny way, I'd gone to Salzburg for the music festival, and I was in the Schwimmbad one day, the swimming pool, and I noticed that a rather distinguished-looking gentleman with one leg, which was an inch shorter than the other, was eyeing me. And I didn't know about such things in those days. But anyway, he turned out to be French, and I spoke French because I'd been in school in Switzerland as a boy, and we became friends. I must say he was a perfect gentleman. As soon as he decided that I was not interested, he couldn't have been more kind and polite and bought me several good dinners, and then somehow the conversation got around to Gertrude Stein. Turned out he was Gertrude Stein's best French friend. His name was Bernard Faye. He was at the Sorbonne, and he was the great interpreter of American history for the French. He said, would you like to meet her? I said, oh, I'd love to meet her. I've read her, and I think she's very interesting. And so he said, I'll fix it up for you. And he wrote to Gertrude and said, can I bring a young man along? She was at her farm there in the south of France in the summer. And she wrote back, or she telegraphed back. And the telegram said, will he do any work? And I was consulted, and I said, yes, he will do some work. So we went to Gertrude Stein's farm, which was in near the Lac d'Ancy, near the Savoy Mountains in the south.
Jay, let me just get a word in here. I don't like to bring this up, but wasn't Fay the librarian of the Bibliothèque Nationale?
Well, there's a whole story about Fay. What happened to poor Bernard was that he, when the Germans came in, he stayed, and he became a collaborator and knew the right people, and he was made a librarian of the Bibliothèque Nationale by his friends, with the idea that this would keep him out of trouble. That, you know, after all, a librarian is not dangerous. And so they thought they stashed him away in the Bibliothèque Nationale, nothing would happen to him. But unfortunately, when the French came back in, they dug up Bernard and they sent him off to jail somewhere. And he languished there for many years, but he did get out. I heard from him later, and he had a reasonably quiet old age.
Yeah, well, excuse me that interruption.
But we went down to her beautiful farm there. It was called Bilignan, and near Belay, and near the Lac d'Ancy, where the poet Lamartine used to sit on his camp chair several centuries before writing those atrociously romantic poems. And the work that she wanted me to do, it turned out, was to write press releases for her American lecture tour. She was going to lecture. A lecture tour had been set up for her all through the United States, and someone had told her that whenever she went to a new city, she must have ready a one-page press release digest of her lecture for the press. So she started me in on these things. Well, her lectures were brilliant and totally incomprehensible. They were written in Steinese, not in her Alice B. Toklas style, but in pure Steinese, and they were very epistemological, and I suppose later on, since the structuralists have arrived on the scene, we could say that they were super deconstructed. They were very hard to understand. In the first attempts I made, you know, I'd do my best to get this down on a page, and I'd bring it to her, and she'd say, no, go back and do it again. So it took me nearly a month to finish the work. And I might confess that I was having such a very good time there, and Alice B. Toklas and her assistant were such superb cooks that I wasn't hurrying with the work. But there was also there what you might call an athletic program in that curriculum. And the athletic program there for Gertrude consisted in changing tires on her Ford. Every afternoon, she and Alice would go out. They had this lovely, I think it was a Model A, nice little Ford, the latest thing in those days. And she and Alice would sit in front, and Gertrude driving. She was a very strong driver. You know, she was a really muscular woman. And I would be consigned to the back seat with two of the most awful dogs I have ever had any association with. One of them was a white poodle named Basket, and the other was a little Mexican nothing dog named Pepe. And they both licked me continually. And I was not allowed to smite them, to stop them from licking, because if I did, Alice was keeping an eye on me in the rearview mirror, and she would say to me, Jay, be nice to the dogs. They're nice to you. Well, in those days, there were a great many nails on the roads in that part of the country from hikers and mountain climbers, and so we'd get maybe sometimes two, sometimes three punctures in a day. And then Gertrude and Alice would get out of the car, and they would appropriately sit with their backs to the view, because, as you'll recall, Gertrude has explained that the only way to take in a view is to sit with your back to it. And they would take out their little teapot or whatever they had, and I would change the tires. And we would go on as long as tires were left. She had about four spares on the top of the car. Then we would return to the garage, to Belay, and the tires would be repaired, and we'd pick them up for the next day's jaunt. But it was a very happy life. But I finally got into trouble on two counts. The one was solved by Alice B. Toklas. Gertrude was insistent that I should take a bath every day. I don't know whether I smelt or why, but she would ask me before dinner, she would say, "Jay, have you had your bath today?" And I would usually say, "Well," or "Yes," or "Maybe." And the reason I was afraid of the bathtub, I mean, I'm, you know, reasonably cleanly. I still take a bath once a week. And the reason that that I was concerned was, you know what a geyser is? This is a thing that you made hot water with in the old days, where I think it was, you had to light it as you would light a gas stove, and then it would heat the water for the bath.
For one bath.
But the damn thing would spurt a column of flame out at you. And I was terrified. And so I finally confessed to Gertrude what was stopping my cleanliness, and she said, "You are a sissy, Jay, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, Alice will turn on the geyser for you." So that solved that problem. But a really, really serious problem developed when one day she caught me reading Proust. And she said, "Are you reading that junk?" I said, "Yes, very interesting." She said, "Don't you realize that both that man Joyce and that man Proust copied their books from my Making of Americans?" So I never recovered from that. I mean, I had by then completed the press releases, and so I sort of fell from favor. But I always cherished the dearest thoughts of Gertrude. She was a very great, great woman. And, of course, the pictures that she had collected and she had in her apartment there in Paris were just superb.
Well, just two footnotes here, Jay. You did bring her Making of Americans back into print, didn't you?
No. We brought back The Three Lives.
Three Lives.
Which is the book modeled on Flaubert's Trois Contes. It's the three fairly long stories, almost novellas, about servant women. This is one of the best things I think she ever wrote, because this she wrote fairly early on, and she hadn't gotten so complicated. And she was still writing conventional syntax, and she had a marvelous ear, and she had a marvelous knowledge of psychology.
Did she thank you for that? Did she appreciate that?
I think vaguely, yes, yes. She did. I mean, we didn't break off. It is just that she wanted from everyone who were around her, she wanted complete adulation. I mean, you had to think she was the greatest, and if you didn't keep voicing that thought, well, you sort of drifted out of her ken.
Well, but you published Pound. You, of course, no one else was publishing him when you began to publish.
Oh, yes, he was. He had had...
he had Boni.
That was Williams had Boni. He had had Alfred Knopf had brought out...
Cathay?
No, Alfred Knopf had brought out Instigations, the book of essays, and the other, he'd done two books of essays.
But he hadn't kept them in
print.
And
he had done Lustra. He had done the one of the early books of poems.
He hadn't kept them in print, though.
No.
Well, you published Pound, and you kept him in print, and he's still in print.
Now, I think we have in print, we have kept in print every book of Pound's that we were ever able to get our hands on. Yeah, well, and, of course, they don't all sell equally well. Some of them are just a trickle, the more esoteric books. But the major books, now the Candos, despite the fact that it's now an $18 book, sells 1,500 copies a year. And the Selected Poem sells about 15,000. The ABC of Reading sells about 10,000. So that the good, what happens in a deal like this is that the books that sell carry the ones that are slow. But it's always been my intention, if I could, when possible, to keep the principal works of an important author in print.
Well, indeed it has been, and you've done it as no one else has. There are two names I have written down here, and they're certainly not related, but they have the same last name. And you had a close publishing relationship and a personal friendship with both, namely William Carlos Williams and Tennessee Williams.
The two Williams as though they weren't... Well, they knew each other slightly, only no relation. William Carlos Williams was one of the people which... is it whom? Or is it... No, that is not correct. Whom is correct. Ezra had put me in touch with, and he'd written to him and said, here's this young man who was interested in publishing, and you should see him. So I went down to see Williams, where he was living there. He was a doctor, you know. He was a pediatrician and obstetrician in a little town of Rutherford, New Jersey. And he lived there all his entire life, from the time of his got out of medical school until he died. He was he brought in over 3,000 babies, they tell me. He was a very lovable, though occasionally could be a little testy. Not testy, I mean a little sharp, a little... If he didn't like something, he would tell you so. And I remember once he wrote to me and he said, you've got to stop publishing all these second-raters in your anthology. And, well, Ezra used to say the same thing, too. I can read you what Ezra said about that. But Williams was... he was a terribly lovable man, again, very charismatic. One of the handsomest pictures of him on our covers of his early books, he is so handsome, it's unbearable, almost a good-looking, rugged, fine, sensitive-looking man, and that's what he was. He had a very split life. He was a hard-practicing doctor, and in those days, of course, and especially being an obstetrician, doctors had to make house calls at night.
Isn't that an industrial town, Rutherford?
Well, it's near one. Rutherford is sort of, it's not exactly a suburb of New York, but it's mostly small houses. But the industrial area, which he wrote about in his great poem, Patterson, is the towns of Passaic and Patterson, which are adjacent. And he was a wonderful character, and we got on very well. And then when I was able to pull together the money, I brought out, as one of our early books, I brought out to his novel, his first novel in the Stecker trilogy, which is the story of his wife's family. It's a wonderful book. It's about how immigrants get to be Americans and develop new attitudes toward life. And I published that in 1936. And at that time, I always loved this letter because I'm sure it's the only letter in which my divinity has been recognized. He wrote to me after that, or just before it, he said, "Dear God, you mention casually that you are willing to publish my White Mule, that you will pay for it, and that we shall then share, if any, the profits. My God, it must be that you are so tall that separate clouds circle around that head, giving thoughts of other metal than those the undersides of which we are in the habit of seeing." Now, it's a pretty nice letter to get. And fortunately, we had quite a pretty good success with White Mule. I think it went into two printings, and there was a brilliant review by Alfred Kazin in the Times or someplace, so that it got us off to a good start on the relationship. And then after that, I did his poems for many years, and I brought back into print his greatest prose book, which is In the American Grain, those wonderful sort of essay-poetic prose passages where he attempted to recreate the spirit of American history going all the way back into the early history in Latin America.
But his autobiography is a beautiful book.
Oh, yes. That's a lovely book.
Can't think of the name.
Just as autobiography. Of course, I think some of his poetry is, to me, very great, though I always remember... Donald Davy, the great British professor who now teaches here, saying at one conference somewhere that the worst two influences on young writers were William Carlos Williams and D.H. Lawrence. But to me, he's been a very great, good influence, and I think his poetry is very beautiful, and I think that Patterson, his long personal epic, where he was obviously influenced by the fact that his friend Pound had written the cantos, but he's going to write it entirely in his own way, and he does, is if you can figure out a little bit what's going on, it's a very wonderful poem. And then even the poems of his last years, the pictures from Bruegel, which won the Pulitzer Prize posthumously, those are extremely beautiful. And he was certainly one of the real innovators in the modern poetic movement, the man who worked out a different way of writing free verse. He was always pressing to make his free verse more measured, more structured, and I think he succeeded toward the end after he worked it out.
How would you connect him with Tennessee Williams?
I think the only, there's not much connection. Tennessee came from St. Louis and was very Southern. They did, however, both write plays. Now, William Carlos Williams wrote about five plays. They have been played. They have been seen in the Village and off Broadway, but they're not really. He didn't really know how to construct a play for the theater. If you want to read one of them, the one I would recommend is the one called A Dream of Love, which is autobiographical, and I won't spoil it for you by telling you what the plot is, but it's pretty good, at least to read, even though when it's played, it's a little shaky.
Well, Ezra certainly never sent you to Tennessee, Williams.
No, I met Tennessee at a cocktail party at Lincoln Kirstein's. Lincoln, you know, is the great. He was the fellow who first published The Bitch and Bugle, as Ezra called it, and then later he became the patron of Balanchine's ballet. In fact, he was the one who brought Balanchine to this country, and he's really the great saint now of American ballet. And it was at a party at his house that I first met Tennessee, that I never cared much for cocktail parties and got very shy. And I noticed in the far end of the apartment was this little guy in sort of baggy pants and a torn gray sweater. And he was obviously unenjoying the party as much as I was. So I went and started to talk to him. And he was very nice, always friendly to talk to. And I talked, you know, wormed it out of him that he was a young playwright, that he'd written a couple of short plays, and that he liked poetry. And his favorite poet was Hart Crane, who was also one I admired very much. And that he said that when he went around the country hitchhiking, he would always carry a volume of Hart Crane in his knapsack. And that was the beginning of a friendship which lasted up until his death last year, and I think I published about 25 of his plays, two volumes of his short stories. And if you've never read his short stories, he is a marvelous short story writer, a simply marvelous short story writer. And if he had, you know, if he hadn't become so famous in the theater, he would be known for those short stories, and I earnestly recommend them to you. He has a simply magical style, which is slightly comic. Whatever he's talking about, he will give it a slightly, softly comic touch. And then this beautiful, flowing Southern prose. I mean, you know, Truman Capote isn't a patch on him. And we also did two volumes of his poetry. And his poetry is highly romantic, very romantic, and a bit lush, reflecting some of his, shall we say, preferences. And he would never take any pains with his lines. Everything was pretty rough, but it's very, if you like romantic poetry, he is very, very good.
You took your authors that you thought were worth publishing, you took them personally as you found them then. You didn't bring judgments to any of these writers, did you?
Well, they weren't the kind, you mean, did I
you didn't,
change things?
You didn't judge them, no, they're personally, you didn't tend to
oh,
judge.
Oh, you mean, did I like their characters?
They're so different, you see.
Oh, no, I didn't fuss with their characters, never. I mean, after all, we published Céline, the great French novelist, who was a paranoid anti-Semite. Pound, later in his life, became a paranoid anti-Semite. I just never thought it was up to me to play God and try to tell these guys how to straighten themselves out.
Yeah. Well, Ezra did, of course.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't learn anything from Ezra then that was bad, did you?
Well, would you rephrase the question?
Yeah, no, let's back away from that one.
No, I think we should face up to the truth about Ezra, that he was anti-Semitic, that he thought Mussolini was the nuts. But you must look at this medically as well as morally. I learned from Ezra's doctors at the St. Elizabeth Hospital when they had him down there, you know, after he'd done those broadcasts, and they put him in the hospital instead of hanging him, that the head doctor there said, this is a medical situation. He is anti-Semitic because he is paranoid. He is paranoid because the world never accepted his economic ideas. And you must look at it also in that light. And, you know, at the time of the great Bollingen controversy, after all the poets had given him the Bollingen Prize, there was all this hue and cry about, can a bad man write a good poem? You know, this was the kernel of it. Well, I think, yeah, he can write bad poem and good poem. I mean, obviously, the two suppressed cantos, 72 and 73, which he wrote in Italian and which I have read, are pretty bad stuff. And there is bad stuff in those wrong broadcasts. But there is so much else in the cantos that is totally life-enhancing and beautiful that I think the answer is he can write both.
Well, I think this distinguishes you, Jay, if I may say. I know you don't like me to speak of you personally. You'd rather keep New Directions as just a name, and it was a long time before you identified your name, Jay Lachlan, with the publishing house. But still, it seems to me the kind of tolerance and acceptance that you've brought to your author's list is not unique in American publishing, but certainly it's a shining example.
Well, I don't know how shining it is, but you can't interfere in your author's lives or they won't stick around. You know, they're living their lives. They know what kind of lives they want to live, and it's not up to the publisher to be a therapist to them. I mean, you can occasionally I've had said, you know, I'll come off it. So I mean, Edward Dahlberg, I used to tell him what I thought of his life, but he'd already told me so many times what he thought of me that it was sort of just hitting the ball back into his court.
I got on his you know what list too one time, and he came to see me at UCLA, and he said, I'm a writer, you know, but I don't come for that reason. I want a job for my wife. She can type, and I want you to hire her as a typist, and then I can go home and write books. Well, it so happened she was a very good typist, and she was a very attractive person, and we put her out front at the loan desk, and it certainly encouraged
business. This was Arlene?
Yes, it was Arlene.
Oh, she was a beauty.
Yeah, exactly.
And what she saw in that awful man.
Yeah. That's exactly what I thought, too. But certainly the circulation went up at the loan desk.
Well, you know, de mortuus nihil nisi bonum, but
exactly.
I'm still getting back at Edward.
Good. I'm not through either. So.
No. I should have been tipped off because the first time that I took him out to lunch, and I wasn't going to buy him very good lunch. First, I think we went somewhere and got a pastrami sandwich, and he looked at me and he said, we got on the subject of Edmund Wilson, and he said, Edmund Wilson, he said, the man's an ignoramus. I should have gotten the message. And then there was just one succession of terrible fights about everything, culminating with the day that he came into the office one day, and the telephone girl had very beautifully pasted up on the wall of her cubicle, which was also the entrance wall, some lovely jackets from recent books. And Edward inspected them all closely, and he didn't find one of his. So then he tore off the wall every jacket that was on it and stomped out of the office.
He was a bastard. I lent him books. I lent him books at UCLA. He never brought them back. I don't know. That's the last thing to do to a librarian. At any rate, but I kept his wife on. All right, let's see. I've got a couple of names here that I'd like to mention, and they're two foreign writers, one Russian, one German, that you had something to do with. The first is Nabokov.
Oh, he was a marvelous, marvelous man, as well as a very great writer. It always grieved me that he didn't get the Nobel Prize. I think he deserved it, just for pure invention and glorious style. But he was wonderful, you know. He was a real Russian aristocrat. He came one of the great landed families, and this dawned upon me when one day he told me that in the old days before the Tsar had fallen, when his grandfather took the whole family to the French watering place, Biarritz, in the south of France, that the carriage and the family horses for the carriage were sent on ahead by railroad. And that's the background he came from. It. The wonderful thing was that he survived a complete destruction of his family and fortune, and because he had this resolute drive to be a great writer, and he became a great writer. My contact with him was through his books. I did his wonderful book of his.
Sebastian.
Yeah, Sebastian Knight. It's a marvelous book. It's one of these books where you don't know quite what is happening, or who is who. Who is whom? I recommend it to you. It's a beautiful, beautiful, flawless, exquisite piece of novel construction.
But you didn't publish Lolita. Why not?
Well, because I didn't think my mother would like it.
That's not a joke. That's the truth, I'm sure.
That's the truth, yes. That's why I didn't publish Henry Miller's Tropic books. Because the way I learned about Henry Miller was that one day Henry had sent a copy of Tropic of Cancer to Ezra and Rapallo, and we were having lunch, and Ezra tossed this book across to me, and he said, "Here, Jess, is a dirty book that's really pretty good." And then I wrote to Henry, and we set up a correspondence which continued for a great many years, in fact, up to the time of his death. And I published about 20 books of Henry's, but they were always the essays, or the books about other writers or about anything of that kind.
Because, and the travel books, The Colossus of Maroussi,
that
certainly
was
one of his
book.
Finest books. And you've kept them in print.
Yes, they're not all in print, but they're most of them in print.
Well, a lot of publishers have published, and then if it wasn't a big seller, they let the author die. But you never let anyone die, did you?
Many authors have gone to the happy hunting ground.
Yeah, but not because you didn't keep their books in print.
Well, we tried. But, this, of course, the sales of the kind of books that we publish, they don't really provide an income for anybody.
Well, let's mention one that did, and it was Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha.
I owed entirely to Henry Miller. Henry Miller had received from a lady in England who had done a translation of it, Hesse's Siddhartha, which is, this pseudo-Buddhist one about this joker in old-time India who is sort of like the Buddha. And it's a sort of a popularization of Buddhist principles, but told in a very glamorous Indian story. And I read this thing, that's what I thought it was, and I wrote back to Henry, and I said, "Henry, this isn't really so hot." And he kept writing back to me every few months, and he said, "You've got to publish Siddhartha." So after about 2 years, I said, "Okay, Henry, we'll give it a fling." And we brought it out, and the first year it sold about 400 copies. And the next year was a little more, and the next year a little more. Then the great Hesse boom came on in the American colleges, when they were reading Steppenwolf and Damian and Goldman and Narcisse and all that stuff. And that, I think it ended up when, at its peak, it was selling 250,000 copies a year. So that paid for a lot of poets and short story writers and whatnot.
And there was another one that that helped with the poorer sellers, and that was the Ferlinghetti's. It's the City Lights Bookshop in San Francisco and Columbus Avenue. His Coney Island of the Mind. How did you come on that?
Well, that thanks to Rex Roth, Kenneth Rex Roth, who I might say that Rex Roth, when Ezra got so involved with economics that was all he wanted to write me about, and he wasn't giving me much advice anymore, I turned to Rex Roth, whom I had met through mountaineering connections, and he sort of succeeded Rex, uh, Pound as my literary mentor. I used to go down and visit him in California, and again in San Francisco, and again it was sort of like the SUversity, because I could stay there with him, and all I had to contribute was the price of a few groceries every day, and I had the run of his library and all the benefit of his explanation of what made literature and what in culture was good and why the Chinese poets were important and that kind of thing.
He had that same encyclopedic interest that Ezra had, didn't mm-hmm. he? Wide-ranging languages, subjects,
everything.
Name it, he was interested in it and knew something about it.
Beyond that, he had a photographic memory. Any piece of paper that went in front of his eyes went right into that computer, what do you call it, that floppy disk. And he could remember everything he had ever written. I've seen this machine operating. He used to like after lunch to take a long hot bath in a tub, and there was across the tub there'd be a reading board, and he would be lying there reading, and the pages were just turning at about this speed. Like that. And everything was going in there. It was all just going in. So that when he wrote his essays, he never had to look anything up, and he made very few mistakes.
I made one mistake. I asked him to come and lecture at, give a reading at UCLA, and I persuaded Ed, the chairman of the English department, then to sponsor this. And chairmen have their uses, sir, you see. And so I didn't know that it was to be a 9 o'clock class. 9 a.m., and when I told Kenneth Rexroth we're reading at 9 a.m., he wanted to go back to San Francisco. But he came to the class, and he was so mean, and he was so grumpy, and so curmudgeonly, that it was a disaster, really. And I didn't end up reading the poetry, but because I slunk to the back of the room and made myself scarce. But he could be very sharp indeed.
Well, if you'd had the class at about midnight, he would have been superb.
I know, but I wouldn't have been awake. He was a skier, too. You used to ski together, didn't you?
Yes, we made many, many wonderful trips, all winter and summer, up into the Sierra Mountains there in California. He was a great mountain man. He was a natural mountain man, a tremendous love of nature, understanding of nature. And we would go up on both sides of the Sierras. Often we would go up in winter from the Mono Lake side, and we'd hike up in there, and we would dig a sort of a cave bed in the snow, and Kenneth would cut a lot of fir boughs with his knife. Then we'd sleep on these fir boughs in this cave. And he was a great mountain cook, too. He could make more good stuff out of dried apricots and tomato paste. And he, of course, we had slightly different objectives on these ski trips, because I would, you know, be tearing up the mountain and trying to ski down without flattening myself. And Kenneth, very often, if the weather was nice, would spend the whole day sitting on a stump meditating. I mean, absolutely motionless meditating. He was a Buddhist. And this meditation was very important to him. And even when he was living in San Francisco, he had a kind of a little den up on the up toward Muir Woods there, and not in the Redwoods, but in some place in the woods. And he'd go up there and spend the whole day just meditating or reading.
He fell on evil days, as you know, and he spent his last years in Santa Barbara near the campus. His latter years, as you know, he was paralyzed and not able to speak. And it was... And you'll forgive me but saying this, Jay, but it was Jay Laughlin who provided Kenneth Rexroth with nursing care up to his death. You've taken care of your authors in more than one way. There are a lot of other things I've noted here, but I think it's a good time to turn to the audience and recognize them. And anybody that wants to pitch them up here at Jay Laughlin, he'll be glad to respond. Questions, please, no speeches. one at the back.
When you began publishing, how did you get into distribution?
That was the most difficult problem. There were in those days none of these wholesalers who handle the small press books. And so that I tried first to send out circulars to libraries, lists that you could get from that Boker Directory of Libraries, and then I think I bought a couple of lists from magazines like the Partisan Review. But it didn't go very well because, the writers I was involved with had no reputations, and Pound did. I mean, Pound, we could always, sell 500 or 600 of his. So then I tried going out myself during they had a thing at Harvard in those days called a reading period before exams when you're supposed to read. And instead of reading, I would just drive west, stopping in bookstores as far as I had time to go. But the response was pathetic. I mean, I'd wander in there. In those days, I wore an Austrian Lodenmantel, which was a sort of a peasant's cape. And I think this apparition of this new type of salesman did nothing much to move the books. But usually there were these nice ladies who were buyers in bookstores would take pity on me, and they'd say, William Carlos William, who's he? Ezra Pound, who's he? And they didn't have time, for me to educate them. So they'd buy a couple of books, maybe, and this didn't work out very well. I mean, it sold very little. So then we hit on the idea of having what is called commission men. These are bookstores, traveler salesmen who will represent 5 or 6 companies. And that began to help a little bit. But the books really never circulated very well until some of the people like Pound or Williams or Dylan Thomas or Merton became famous enough so that the college bookstores where professors would suggest them, I would please stock this book, I want to use it in my class. And it wasn't until that point was reached that we were in the black. But I have no answer to the problem of distribution. I think it's, how it is. You send the books out, and the stores send them back in 3 weeks for credit because they haven't got shelf space and they haven't got inventory money to carry them. And the books, kind of books we do, don't get reviewed quickly. They get reviewed 3 or 4 months later, and by that time, the bookstores have returned them. It's a very sticky problem.
But it wasn't just money that did this, Jay. It wasn't that you had a family bankroll behind you. It was something else, and it was taste, it was discrimination, it was persistence. It was also the prudence of a thrifty scholar, wasn't it?
Well, we...
You never spent more than you had, did you?
Well, if I did, then I had to write to my mother.
It's a combination, and it's a rare combination, and that's why there's only one New Direction and only one Jay Laughlin. And that's how simple it is. Here's a question here.
Merton? Well, at Columbia, his most beloved professor was Mark Van Doren. And Mark Van Doren lived, by this time I'd moved to Connecticut. Mark Van Doren had a farm about 10 miles away, and I got to know him. I think we met at a square dance, and well, that's all right, square dance. And Merton sent his poems from the monastery up to Van Doren, for asking for his advice about them. And Van Doren liked them, and he sent them to me, and I liked them. And so that's how we started publishing his poetry. And we published, I think, almost all of his poetry and some of his other prose books too, though not all of them, because Merton was such a steamroller writer. I mean, he would, finish 3 and 4 books in a year. I don't know how he did it, because those monks down there in that monastery, they're there in the church singing liturgy 6 times a day, and then in between they have to produce all that cheese, to keep the place going. And I don't know how he managed to write the way he did.
Was he a Trappist?
Yeah, he was a Cistercian.
Cistercian in Kentucky?
In Gethsemane, Kentucky, below Bardstown. Yeah, well, yes. Quadra, Pablo Antonio Quadra, who is still surviving in Nicaragua, and also Ernesto Cardenal, who is now Minister of Culture in the Revolutionary Government of Nicaragua. But some of the other ones came to me from other sources. I mean, I knew Para, Nicanor Para from Chile, before I took him to visit Merton at the monastery, and it was through Para that Merton began to write what he called the anti-poems of the book Apology. And we had part of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men in that with the wonderful Walker Evans photographs. And I saw him maybe twice a year up to the time of his death and revered him very much. I think that Let Us Now Praise Famous Men is one of the great modern American prose classics.
Another question, the lady in blue.
What? Well, you want to do Juna first? Well, Juna, she was an astonishing lady. And we got along pretty well at first, until she decided, she came in the office one day, and she always called me Mr. Lachlan, and I called her Miss Barnes. And she said, Mr. Lachlan, I would like you to publish a new edition of Nightwood on paper which will last for 1,000 years. And I gulped, because I knew that this was rather unlikely, even with a handmade European paper, but I went through the motions and researched it, and finally said, Miss Barnes, the best we can do for you is 500 years. And then she got rather affronted by that, and she got a bit angry, and she was obviously, she loved to bait me, and she was, what her nature was. And she was trying to bait me, and so I controlled my anger, and I said, Miss Barnes, I learned at my mother's knee that I must never fight with a lady. So she stomped out. The next day, I was walking up 6th Avenue to the office. She was walking down the other side of 6th Avenue, and she always carried a sort of big stick. She stopped, and she saw me, and she waved her stick, and she shouted through the traffic of 6th Avenue, she said, Mr. Lachlan, how is your mother's knee today? But she was quite wonderful. But you couldn't really do anything for her. She thought that all publishers except T.S. Eliot, who had helped her write Nightwood, were, just crooks. And any kind of offer that you made to her, she would smell a rat in it. I remember there was one time that, I knew she was pretty hard up, so I said, now, Miss Barnes, Nightwood is a great book, and it is going to last for 500 years. And money will be coming in on this book long after you are dead. I said, I would like to make you the following proposition. I will pay you $100 first of every month. And in those days, $100 was pretty good money. And this will simply be charged up against Nightwood, and you will be under no obligation. And myself or my heirs will recoup this in the course of time. She was absolutely convinced that this was some kind of a crooked deal, and she wouldn't take it. Though she was, she was having a very hard time living. But I admired her very much. I think Nightwood is one of the great prose masterpieces of this century. And I agree with her that it will live. But she drifted off, I mean, she was there. I'd see her occasionally on the street, and she stopped asking about my mother's knee. But she really was sort of going off into a sort of a limbo of her own. There is a nice story about Pound and Juna Barnes that I was visiting him in Venice in the 60s. That was when he had gone into his silent period, and wasn't talking anymore, which can be interpreted in various ways. Some people say it was meditation, and other people say it was, it was mental disturbance. I think he just, as he told me, he said, I've talked enough. I'm not going to talk anymore. Well, anyway, it was at this time when he was silent, and I'd taken him, Olga, his lady who looked after him, had to do some shopping. She said, Jess, will you take Ezra out to lunch? So I took him out to lunch. And I talked and I talked and I talked. Never an answer. Nothing for an hour. And finally I said, Ezra, what was Juna Barnes like when she was in Paris? Was she so beautiful? And he suddenly spoke, and he said, well, she weren't exactly cuddly. And she never was cuddly. I mean, if you met her on Sixth Avenue or in the Jumble Shop restaurant, she weren't cuddly. But she was a marvelous writer.
Any more here? We're yes.
Well, Dahlberg was a strain. But I think that autobiographical book of his, Because I Was Flesh, is a masterpiece. I think it's one of the masterpieces. And I put up, you know, but I didn't want to go on waiting for another one, going through these scenes with him.
Here's a question back here.
Very little. Ezra, you see, his books were edited for him by T.S. Eliot, who would then pass sheets along with us, if you know what I mean. Our sheets of his books would be printed by Faber and Faber in England, and then we'd bind them up here. And Eliot, of course, was a great editor, and he could get away with fixing Ezra up a bit because they were such great friends. But other people, not much. Henry Miller, you couldn't touch a word. Nabokov, you couldn't touch a word. Merton would accept a little bit of, you know, changing the word here and there, but you'd have to show it to him and get his approval of it. Rex Roth, you couldn't change. Most of these people, you know, they were not beginning writers. They were mature people who knew what they wanted, and that was the way it was going to be. And I think the only time that I ever got away with changing anything was in John Hawkes's great novel Lime Twig, which is the one, you know, about the rigged horse race in England. And there I felt that some connectives were needed between the sections. And I told him that, and he thought about it, and he said, yes, you're right. And then he wrote those superb little, they sound like sporting columns in the English press about horse racing by a man whom he invented named Sidney Slighter. But I didn't write them. I just told him something was needed. We do very little editing.
You're designing Alvin Lustig.
Oh, yes. He was a great designer.
He came out of Los Angeles. We knew him over there in his beginning. The only trouble is he thought he was the Messiah.
Oh, he was.
Oh. You're more perceptive than I am, Jay.
Well, he was. Oh, he was he was just absolute revolution in book cover design when he came along, and you can see those on the covers he did for us, the New Classic series. I mean, they're stunning and absolutely original. And then he was the one, it became too expensive for us to use a lot of color on the jackets, and he said, well, I'll design a pattern for you to use only black and white. That's what we've done ever since.
And your logo, who did originally that logo?
You mean the sitting down horse?
Yes.
That may be a centaur. That was done by a sculptor protege of Pound's. You know, Pound was always very good to artists, beginning with Godet Brzeska and many others, the patron artists. And that was a German fellow named Hengis, who turned up in Rapallo, Stony Brook, and having walked down from Hamburg to see Pound because he wanted to talk about Godier, and Ezra, having no beds in his place, put him up in the dog kennel on the terrace. It was a nice big dog kennel. And then Ezra fed him, and he took him over to the local gravestone man, and he vouched for his being given a piece of, I don't think it was marble, I think it was granite or something. And Angus did this beautiful sculpture of what I suppose is a sitting down horse, and then Ezra turned salesman, as he was doing all his life with so many authors, and sold it to Signora Agnelli, the wife of the Fiat man. And this put Angus on his feet, and then he left the dog kennel and became the terror of husbands in the town of Rapallo.
Well, here's one. Yeah.
Well,
I think that it's nice to deal directly with the author, but we have dealt with many agents where an author had an agent. I think most publishers would prefer to deal with the author unless the, unless it were Edward Dahlberg. It would have been great if Edward had had an agent, but unfortunately no agent would have him.
I want to ask you about Sun Valley. Is it true that you started skiing at Sun Valley, Idaho?
No, I started skiing on the slopes of what was then called the Pennsylvania College for Women in Woodland Road, Pittsburgh, at the age of 8.
All right, where did you get to Sun Valley?
Oh, I don't know. 38. But I quickly left there. It was too social and went down to Alda, Utah, which is, when I first went there, was marvelously wild. Practically nobody there. It was great.
Well, we're going to wind up very quickly here now, but I'll recognize a final question if it's a good one. Is it?
Well, supposedly I am doing that, but the circumstances were a little peculiar. I was teaching up at a wonderful, marvelous writers' conference named Centrum up in the Pacific Northwest last year, and one of the people on the program panel was Gordon Lish, a very brilliant editor at Knopf, and we were partying a bit, and next morning Gordon came around and he said, thought you'd like to see the contract that you signed last night. So I don't know whether I'll ever get it written. It's, I can sit here and buzz along, but to put it in, nice form is another story. I'm going to try.
Well, Jay, we're terribly grateful. This is one step only on a reading tour that's taken him the last two stops, Salt Lake and Albuquerque, and he's leaving Thursday for Los Angeles. And then is it back Norfolk, Connecticut?
I hope. Not that I haven't. I mean, it's very exciting to come to universities such as this and meet students and graduate students and people. But, home is home, and I like to be there with my books and my nice person who looks after me. And well, she's here now. I mean, I wouldn't come on these trips if she wouldn't keep on looking after me. But it's been a wonderful experience, and it certainly blows apart the attitudes of the professors at Harvard and Yale who think that cultivation and education stop at the Hudson River. It isn't so.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.